Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 22nd of June. Two shows that focus on important different parts of the world today. We will start with Iran. The second hour of the program, we will be talking about Darfur. It's been a year since President Ahmadinejad's very disputed election in Iran, and we're going to be looking at what's going on in that country since the election. One of our guests this hour writes, 1 year ago, a single violent death captivated the world. 27-year-old Neda Agha Soltan was shot during an anti-government protest in Tehran on June 20th, 2009. Her death caught on camera and broadcast around the world on YouTube. She quickly became a symbol of the protest movement in Iran, but 1 year later, the movement is suffering under the weight of a brutal crackdown. Jim just returned from a rare visit inside Iran. He works for ABC. It was the first by American television reporters since the protests. The government banned them from any contact with opposition leaders, but they met them in secret and hid their identities for their safety. So 1 year after the election, the bitter election, what's going on inside Iran? This first hour of our program today. Our first guest will have two. Jim Sciutto is ABC News' senior foreign correspondent. He is based in London. He moved overseas in 2002 and has reported from more than 40 countries in Europe, Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. His globetrotting has put him on multiple trips to war zones from Iraq to Afghanistan to Israel-Palestine, undercover in Zimbabwe and Myanmar, under fire in Russia, Beslan, and on cross-country tours of China and India for special series. He's won many awards for television for his undercover reporting in Myanmar, and he is with us. His base now is in London. And we should tell you, because I'm always interested in where people start their careers, his first job in TV was as a moderator and producer of The Student Press, a weekly public affairs talk show for U.S. and Canadian college students broadcast on PBS. Hello, Jim. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. So how hard was it for you to get news? You had to meet with people secretly to talk with opposition leaders, right?
Well, this was a case where we were granted visas to cover, you might remember this, this was a good month and a half ago, President Ahmadinejad's alternative nuclear conference. When President Obama was having his in Washington, Iran, uninvited, Ahmadinejad had sort of his own competing nuclear conference, invited his friends to talk about nuclear issues. So we were granted access for that and allowed only to cover that, but I've been to Iran a number of times and was there during the protest last year, so took the opportunity to meet with them just to get the pulse. We knew it was bad. You've heard the accounts of the crackdown, torture, arrests, execution. So I wanted to meet with them face to face. And what I found was, well, it was demoralizing. It was sad. And they've gone through an extremely rough 12 months. I've been saying to friends that it reminded me of, not that I was there, but it reminded me of what I would imagine East Berlin was circa 1975. I mean, secret police, people scared, people staying at home, people worried that their cell phone conversations were tapped, that their phone, that their emails were being watched, text messages, etc. And a lot of that is true. Just the climate, a very deep fear. And that's not imagined. It's because the government has, over the course of these 12 months, cracked down brutally. And the fear is part of that crackdown. So we met with some senior protest leaders, many of them very young, and these are the ones who aren't in prison, because many of them are in prison, and they're on the run. One of them is someone I've known for 5-6 years there, and he was sleeping every night in a different place because he knew if he went home that they would find him and throw him in prison, he thinks, for 10-15 years. Obviously something he wants to avoid. So it was you know, you felt for them, because especially because the hopes were so high, you remember last year.
Sure.
And the change to today is dramatic.
Mm-hmm. And do you still think that those hopes could be forefront at some point in the future, or has the repression been so brutal that it's just knock the spirit out of everybody.
Well, here's the thing. Certainly, they've been knocked back. But what is very clear when you meet and talk with Iranians, it doesn't. And this is a fairly broad cross section of the population. It's extremely easy to find people who aren't happy with their government, and not just unhappy with, but angry at, scared by this government, and that extends to the highest levels of the political hierarchy. You know, the one thing that was different about this uprising was that it wasn't confined to the streets, like something in Myanmar, for instance. You'll remember the monks protest back in 2007. This went very high. Mir Hussein Mousavi, a former prime minister and presidential candidate, Hashemi Rafsanjani, a former president, leaders with real power, or who at least once had real power in Iran, who were trying to do something to change this regime, and they've been stifled as well. Now, partly by just the strength of the regime, partly by their own mistakes, and maybe you know, you'll meet Iranians who will say that their leaders didn't have a backbone, you know, that they backed down as well. So that still exists. The dissatisfaction still exists. The trouble is that the regime holds all the cards. So a movement that once talked of change in days or weeks or months now talks about years. You know, I asked one of the fairly senior protest leaders when he thinks they might be able to get rid of this regime, he said 5 or 10 years.
Oh, so my goodness.
A dramatic ratcheting down of expectations.
Yeah. Are these figures about right? I was reading in The Guardian that the number of people executed this year alone, 115, 5,000 people arrested since last June, 80 have died in street clashes and in detentions, although this article says the real death toll may be far higher.
Yeah, those are similar estimates that I get from dissident groups. It's hard to get an exact number because a lot of this happens in secret. People disappear. They don't know where they went. It's of course hard to say how many were tortured. You just try your best to collect as many verifiable accounts as you can. But those, the 80 killed, 5,000 arrested, those are the general numbers. And remember that those are just a percentage of the protest leaders and protest participants, but that's part of the strategy. Kill, torture, arrest a big enough number to scare the rest away, in effect, mm-hmm. You know, because so that they fear that the same might happen to them, and they really do. Listen, these are young kids, right? A lot of the participants, certainly, but even some of the leaders, they're young. Very brave, still committed, but young. And they're up against a regime that has a tremendous amount of power, and it has people loyal to it. You'll remember the term Basiji. These are sort of government paramilitaries, I suppose, ununiformed security officers. And I've seen them do nasty stuff. You know, when we were in the protest last year, they would come up and beat up women wearing the veil, you know, taking part in the protest. I just remember one image that sticks in my mind, standing there as one of the besieged comes up to a woman and sprays her 2 inches from her eyes with pepper spray or tear gas. It was hard to tell, which is a very painful thing if you've ever been tear gassed. And she was standing there. She wasn't even shouting, just standing on a doorstep watching the protests. And, you know, that takes a special kind of person, doesn't it, to be able to do that kind of thing unprovoked. You'll remember the images, too, of these riot police on motorcycles, two riding a motorcycle and one in the back with a baton, and they would drive through the crowds, run them over, beat them up. I was nearly run over a couple times. Mm. No hesitation to draw blood in this conflict, and it's still going on closed doors.
How well is Ahmadinejad running the country? Do people have jobs? The price of goods fair?
No. It's, you know, the sad irony is that, you know, it's not just being upset with what is widely seen as an unfair, a stolen election. It's bad governance, and that's one reason why the opposition feels that, you know, this isn't dead. You have rising prices. You have an oil-rich country that does a really lousy job of spreading the wealth around. Now, this is a country that still has to import refined gasoline because it doesn't have the refining capacity, which costs a lot, even though it's a massive oil producing nation. It's a decrepit economy. But it's one that's very tightly run by the government. And remember that a lot of the guys in government profit from these businesses. The businesses are run, owned by, profited from by members of the regime or family members of members of the regime.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Jim is a senior correspondent for ABC News, and he has recently returned from the only television crew to get inside Iran on the first anniversary of the bitterly disputed election. It's hard to believe that was a year ago, of President Ahmadinejad in Iran. They had a chance to interview some people with the opposition, had to do so very quietly in areas that were supposedly safe, for fear of their own safety and, of course, the people who are speaking to the television cameras. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Bonnie in Madison. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks very much. I was just thinking about my questions. They kind of take me back to the 80s and the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, when it seems like the news media mostly interviewed like middle class people who were more inclined to be disaffected with the regime. Now, our focus, it seems like our press's focus is on Ahmadinejad. So my questions are, I'm wondering about the extent of his support. I know he does have some, from what I've heard, mostly among the poor and uneducated people, who I would imagine like his tough talk against the West. And so I'd like the guests to comment on that. And then also the actual extent of his power, because I've heard from experts on your shows and in other places that it's more like the clergy or some upper circles that have the real power. He has some, but not as much as popular opinion in this country would you'd expect. Here.
Thanks, Bonnie, very much for your questions. Jim.
Well, first of all, thank you, Bonnie. Two very smart points. One on, you know, there is a temptation. Journalists, when they go to Iran, they tend to spend most of their time in Tehran, the capital, which can be misleading because it's a cosmopolitan city. You have a disproportionate percentage of young people, educated people, wealthier than some of the smaller cities or the rural areas. So you can get the misimpression that everyone thinks alike. If you go, just like if you went to just New York City and made conclusions about all of the U.S. But what was different about these protests were that they were spread to several cities in Iran, big and small, and you would see that evidence. You saw a lot of YouTube videos. Often, you know, YouTube, that's where you would see both video accounts and eyewitness accounts of the events during the election protests, and they were spread around the country. You also knew that the dissatisfaction extended beyond the urban areas, because when you looked at the election numbers, they were clearly fudged, not just in the cities, but in some of the rural areas. Towns, for instance, that were the hometowns of the other candidates that strangely voted 100% for Ahmadinejad, you know, things like that. If they were so clearly, you know, if they were fudging the numbers in those places, they must have seen the need to fudge the numbers, which would give an indication that there was dissatisfaction outside the cities. That's on that point. On the you asked as well, what was the second question? You'll have to remind me.
The extent of his power.
It is certainly true that the most powerful man in Iran is not Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. It is the supreme leader, Khamenei. And that's the way the government has been built since Khomeini's times back in 79, that it was going to be an elected government, but with a superior role for the clergy, and the supreme leader would in effect, it should be, in theory, it was meant to be power sharing over time. The supreme leader generally had more power, and in recent years you've seen the clergy take more and more of that power. So this delicate balancing act has disappeared in effect, so that I shouldn't say clergy, because there's disagreement in the clergy. Many of the clerics in the holy city of Qom, Q-O-M, did not support Ahmadinejad. But in terms of the power of the supreme leader, this principal member of the clergy does have the most power in the country. But what he did in this last year was, in effect, throw his lot in with President Ahmadinejad. The read before had been that Ahmadinejad was kind of a tool of the Supreme Leader. He would use him when he needed to, make him shout at America, rile up the troops, and so on, that kind of thing. But in effect, by supporting the results of this election early on, even before the votes were counted, he threw his lot in. So the two of them are now wedded for better or for worse.
Hmm. Thanks, Bonnie, so much for the call. You talk in an article that you wrote about this for ABC that opposition supporters pay emotional tribute to Netta's grave, but the regime is at work there too, defacing her gravestone and undercover police lurking about the mourners.
Mm. This is another place we had to go to very delicately in Iran, because Netta's grave, it's in the main cemetery. It's the same cemetery. It's a huge cemetery just outside of Tehran, Beheshtizara. It's where the huge mausoleum is to Khomeini, the architect of the revolution. But it's also where average Iranians are buried. So she's buried there amongst just another gravestone in a sea of gravestones, except that hers has many more flowers than anyone else's, because people come there, and that's a emotional way to show support, in effect, for the protest movement. But you have to do that very delicately. The government is watching. It has prevented people from holding mini rallies there. It has told her family members, yes, they can go visit, but don't try to do anything there. And they were scared to meet with us because they know they're being watched. So we went anyway. We hopped a taxi there. Acted like we were going to see the mausoleum, walked around a bit, and spent some time at the gravesite. And we saw people still braving that risk to pay tribute there. But then when we looked at the face of the gravestone, we'd seen that someone had gone with a chisel or something on her face. Because in the gravestone, an image of her face is kind of carved in there. Just about the worst thing you could do. A young woman who was killed, basically a bystander to the protests. And as we were there, hoping to meet some people who were coming to see her grave, someone quietly sat next to us, didn't look us in the eye, kind of whispered to us, and by pointing quietly, subtly, while looking away, made it clear that we were being watched. And we looked over, and it was very clear we were being watched. You can spot security officers, in my experience, in any country from a mile away. They look the same. They have the same look in their eyes. I think they go to the same tailor and smoke the same cigarette.
Oh, my gosh.
But they were there, and they were watching. And they were watching us. So we spent a little more time there and left and hoped that they didn't follow us home.
Jim Sciutto, ABC's News senior foreign correspondent, who's just returned from Iran. He is based in London and joins us by phone from London this morning. Our number is 800-486-8655. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter at the Kathleen Dunn Show, that is. So feel free to do that. Lines are open for Jim right now. He'll be with us a few more minutes, and then we'll continue on the subject with a different guest. We'll speak with an Armenian who was born in Iran and raised in England, who teaches now in the Department of History at the City University of New York Graduate Center. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next call is Todd from Hill Point. Hi, Todd.
Good morning. I really enjoyed this program. Thanks for having Jim on. Maybe a two-part question for Jim. One is, in light of the fact that the Western governments and the U.S. government seem to do very little during the protests, did he hear from any of the people that he talked to in his most recent trip any frustration that there was little support, verbally or anything, by Western governments? And secondly, just curious, Jim, if you thought that would have made any difference in the outcome.
Good question. Short answer is yes, absolute frustration that there wasn't more support from the West. And it's interesting, though, because it's another one of those delicate balancing acts. Early on, during the protests last year, many protest leaders I spoke with, and I would ask them that very same question, would say, no, not now, not too aggressively, because that's something that's easily exploited by the regime to say, oh, these protesters are inspired, directed by Washington and London, which is a charge that you heard leveled by the regime regardless. But protest leaders wanted to minimize contact to some degree with the West because they didn't want to be seen to be the puppets of the West. But as things got worse, I heard that hesitation fade because people were scared, they were getting crushed, they were paying a heavy price, and they wanted to see something more and didn't. So you hear that frustration today, certainly, and also frustration with their own leaders, that their leaders didn't have a better plan, didn't keep it going further, that people like Rafsanjani, the former president, for instance, seemed to back down over time to protect his own interests, in their view.
And thanks for your call, Joel in Stevens Point. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I don't want to get off topic too much, but back in 1979, when our military personnel were taken hostage in the time of Ayatollah Khomeini, fast forward to the time of Ahmadinejad's election, I remember on national television, one of those hostages came on national TV and said that Ahmadinejad was one of the hostage holders at that time. He said, and I can't remember the fellow's name, but he said, the president today of Iran was one of the people that held him hostage. And that really sparked my interest big time. And then it went away and I never heard anything more about it. Were you aware of anything of that, or did you hear anything of that, or know anything of that?
I did hear that story was out, I guess, a couple years ago, and looked into and not corroborated. It doesn't look like it's true that he was one of the hostage takers. Ironically, I met last year one of the hostage takers. I have a picture of him in my phone, and he is someone who now criticizes this regime. You hear this often in Iran. The original revolutionaries from 1979, who had a very different picture of what their country would look like after the revolution, today very vocally criticize this regime. It's interesting in my experience in Iran. I've been going there for 6 years. It's not forever, but in my time, and just looking back to the last 25 years, as you read about it, the center has constantly moved so that yesterday's hardliners are today's moderates because the hardliners get harder and harder over time. Mir Hussein Mousavi, a prime minister in the late 80s, he was no softy. He was a tough guy. There were dissidents were killed during his government, but he today is the leader of the Green Movement because these guys who were never softies consider the current regime true nut jobs, and they will use that term. It just shows you how the center has moved over time there as this regime has gotten more and more hard line, moved to the right.
Ron in La Crosse, hi.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, a parallel here between the rise of the Third Reich in Germany and the hardening of this regime and its establishment. It always seems to be people who live in the hinterlands who aren't as well educated that seem to be the base of support for all of these, I'd say, inflexible, rigid regimes like the Third Reich. The Nazis' stronghold was in Bavaria and the more southern, the rural areas of Germany where Germans weren't as educated, you know, and they wanted someone who represented strength and stability, so they pitched their star to Hitler, but he was anything but stable. And it seems to be the truth in Iran, the same thing. The rural areas seem to support this sort of hard line. We got to get tough. We got to need a leader that has some backbone, some grit, you know. It seems to be and the U.S. is no exception, I think. They tend to be. Well.
Jim?
Well, I think it's not so clear-cut in Iran. I mean, certainly a guy like President Ahmadinejad has a strong rural base of support, but he also has support in some cities. If you go to South Tehran, which is generally a bit less wealthy, you will find, and I have during this election and past election, Ahmadinejad's strongholds. And also, you'll find in his regime some smart people. I mean, well, this guy, Ahmadinejad, was the mayor of Tehran in his previous political life. So his family does come from the countryside, but he himself is not a country bumpkin. So it's not perfectly clear, clean cut there.
Mm-hmm. And my final question to you concerns change and how gradual change is there. It's terrible to think about this horrible, brutal repression taking place, people dying, being beat up, jailed, etc. What would change that equation so that change would be more rapid?
Well, it's hard to say, really. I mean, it's interesting. I talk to Iranians inside and outside Iran, and one good friend, Karim Sajapour, is with the Carnegie Endowment. He's an Iranian American. He said, you know, if we know this regime is the Soviet Union, that is a regime that's unsustainable. Question is it 1987 and we're near the end, or is it 1967 and are we a generation away from the end? And mm-hmm. And Iranians don't know. They really don't know. I mean, they still have hope, but this last year has shown that this regime can weather a very serious popular storm. But what we also know is that anger is still there. I still see it when I go, and that's something that is not disappearing. It's arguably getting worse, especially because the economic situation is getting no better.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say what the magic bullet is, if there is one. But remember, we were surprised by, no one predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall, did they? So these things can change fairly quickly.
Thank you, Jim, so much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Jim Sciutto, senior foreign correspondent for ABC News, who has done reporting. He's home now in London, which is home, after reporting inside Iran for ABC News. We are continuing 1 year since the questionable election in Iran and bitterly disputed election in Iran. What's going on in that country? What's happened to the once vibrant opposition movement? Changing guests now. Our guest now is Professor Ervand Abrahamian, a distinguished professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern history and politics at Baruch College, City University of New York. He is Armenian-born in Iran and raised in England, and teaches world and Middle East history. He has published Iran Between Two Revolutions, The Iranian Mojahideen, Khomeinism, Tortured Confessions, and Inventing the Axis of Evil. And he's working now on two books. One is The CIA Coup in Iran, and another, A History of Modern Iran. Professor Abrahamian, thank you so much for joining us this part of the program.
Thank you for having me.
Our last guest was talking about the brutal repression that has taken place since last year. Would you verify that? Would you say the opposition has been beaten into submission?
Well, the costs of demonstrating in the streets have drastically gone up. So you risk really being not only having your head smashed in, dragged to jail, but also raped and beaten up in jail. So as a result, I think people are much more reluctant to come out into the streets. But in terms of opposition, of resentment and anger at the regime, I would say it's even increased since the June elections last year. It's just the opposition isn't open in the street. It's simmering. It's down there. And this often happens in Iranian history. Resentments, opposition doesn't disappear. It goes underground and waits until there is an opportune moment in future. Then it comes pouring out, as it did in 1978-79, and produced the Islamic Revolution of that time.
And the anger has grown because of the repression and also because the government is not very effective?
Also, no, the contempt the government has shown to the public, that, you know, these are just specks of dirt who opposed the results, who refused to accept the results, that the term they often use is get over it, you lost. This really, I think, angers the opposition, as much as the fact that there was so much hanky-panky during the election.
Tell me about the time when you were in Iran.
Well, I was there. I was born and lived there a long time ago. So my period is, you know, under the old regime, which had its own problems, very different problems. It was very oppressive, but it was not the same type of religious oppression. It was much more of a sort of state fascistic type of oppression.
Mm-hmm. And how do you keep an opposition movement alive when the crackdown has become more severe, when so many people have been beaten to death or arrested, or a lot of people, my understanding is, have left the country? How do you keep that momentum going?
It's not so much momentum. It's, I think, that as long as the sentiments against the regime are there, it may not have organizational forms. Of course, nowadays with internet websites and so on, there is that new ways of continuing to keep alive the voice of the opposition. But organizationally, it's very hard, and that's not new. I mean, the regimes throughout history have been able to dismantle opposition organizations and prevent them appearing, but that doesn't really solve the problem. Somehow the regime has to win over the confidence of the public, and it's done very little to do that.
Mm-hmm. Who are the people who support the regime?
Usually the stereo image is the lower classes, the peasantry, the people who have less education and also have benefited from economic programs of the regime. There is an element of truth in that, but the real core of the regime is actually what I call evangelical public. It's about 30% of the public in past elections you can define as evangelical, and they support what they call themselves the principalists, or what we would call fundamentalists. And their stress is basically on religious orthodoxy of Shiism, plus the idea of the return of the Messiah pretty soon. So it's actually, ironically, not very different from American politics, where you get about 25-30% that's evangelical. And much of that evangelical vote, of course, could come from less educated, less well-off population. But that doesn't mean the poorer classes automatically support the regime. It's that evangelical core, which is about, in Iran as in the United States, 25-30% of the electorate. So Ahmadinejad has in his pocket that core support, but that's not enough for him to win elections. That's why most people think that the last election, they had to do massive rigging to get from 30% to 66%.
Mm-hmm. You say most people think that. Do you think that?
Yes, yeah. Well, I think it's possible that Ahmadinejad got more votes than his opponents. But in the Iranian electoral system, you needed to get 50% plus. Otherwise, you had to have a runoff. And the regime couldn't afford a runoff, because what had happened in the last week of the elections is it lost control of the streets, because every time there was a debate on television, the whole country watched the debates, and then people would pour out into the streets making fun of Ahmadinejad and supporting the opposition. And if there was a runoff, you'd have to have an electoral campaign. By the Constitution, you just can't have a runoff without an electoral campaign. And that would have really unraveled the government control over the streets. They had already lost the control in the streets by the last day of the election. So that's why I think they had to do massive rigging to prevent a runoff.
More phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. We're talking about Iran, 1 year since the bitterly disputed re-election of President Ahmadinejad, what's happened to the opposition movement in that country. Our guest this half hour is Professor Ervand Abrahamian, Distinguished Professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern History and Politics. He is at Baruch College, City University of New York, author of a number of books, including A History of Modern Iran and Iran Between Two Revolutions, The Iranian Mojahideen, Khomeinism, and other books. Here's our number if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at The Kathleen Dunn Show. Okay. To you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Tuesday, the author of Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror. Back to phone calls, Saeed in Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to talk about the U.S. policy or U.S. foreign policy towards Iran and towards the very lackluster and anemic support of human rights that came very late in the course of events. Stated reason for that was that the United States did not want the opposition movement in Iran to be tainted as a lackey of foreigners. But I believe that was not the real reason. A Iranian reporter by the name of Masih Ahmadinejad, a female reporter that reported for the opposition, came to the United States to interview Obama, and Obama would not even give her an interview as a clear reflection of his preference for a detente or a comprehensive negotiated settlement with the tyrants that rule over Iran. This, I believe, is the wrong thing. Because if you look back at history and ask yourself, why did the solidarity movement in Poland succeed where the uprising in Czechoslovakia years earlier had failed? It wasn't because the solidarity movement had more dedication or more commitment to cause. It was because of the international milieu that was created around the solidarity movement by the then president, American President Ronald Reagan, and the then Pope. Now the world abandoned the cause of this freedom movement in Iran. The Green Movement in Iran is the most vibrant, most indigenous, most grassroots movement, and it is for rights. It comes from 30-plus years of absolute tyranny, the experience of living under a regime that where one cannot even dress the way that one wants, that takes half of its population, the females, and treats them as second-rate and second-class citizens, has created a state of gender apartheid, within which there is essentially not only no political rights, but there's also no civil rights. This is a civil rights movement, and it will succeed. It's a matter of time. And the regime lost all of its credibility when during the uprising.
Excuse me, is this a question or is this a reading a statement someone has written?
No, he's not reading a statement, but do you want to respond to what he said?
All right. I don't know when it'll end, but go ahead.
Do you have a question, Saeed?
No, my question is this. I mean, the statement I made is I wanted to get your guest's analysis as to if the American response to this and the Western world's response to this was more in support of human rights.
I think what you're doing is paralleling the Polish situation to Iran. In Poland, the main national enemy was the Soviet Union, Russia. So the whole of the national attitude is the fear of Russia. There, U.S. is seen as inherent a good guy, ally who can help the national movement against the Russians. And that's for good historical reasons. In Iran, it's very different. In Iran, the main imperial enemy is the United States. And for historically, again, because of 53, but other reasons too, Iran is seen as the imperial threat. So for a U.S. administration to come and talk about its concern about human rights doesn't go too well in Iran. It smacks very much of hypocrisy. Most Iranians will turn around and say, if U.S. is so concerned about human rights, how come it supported a fascist regime for so long in Iran? If United States is so interested about human rights, how about concern about in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and so on? So although some people in the Green Movement would like American support, most people in Iran, including most people, I would say, in the reform movement, do not want United States actually interfering in internal Iranian politics. So when this crisis occurred last year, it was the American right wing and neoconservatives who wanted United States to get in and start denouncing the regime and coming out openly in support of the reform movement. And this would have been actually counterproductive. It would have undermined the reform movement, and it would have, of course, sabotaged any hope of negotiations on the nuclear issue. So there was a lot of pressure on the Obama administration to come out and support openly the reform movement. And eventually, the administration did actually compromise on this. It did give some statements in support. It would have been better off actually keeping it completely separate, the two issues. The nuclear issue is what U.S. should be really concerned about. The reform issue is an Iranian issue that Iranian reformers should be concerned about. Mixing the two really doesn't work. Mm. All it does is it ends any possibility of trying to improve relations between the U.S. and Iran.
And Professor Abrahamian, what is the best way for the United States to be dealing with the always there nuclear problem?
What should the United States be doing?
Yes.
Well, what it could be doing is basically what the Brazilian and the Turkish governments have tried to do, is get some sort of agreement where Iran will send some of its enriched uranium abroad. And that will, in fact, guarantee that Iran will not be involved in mass production of weapons of destruction. And this was actually the suggestion U.S. made first. Iran made the mistake of not grabbing at it. But a year later, when the Turkish and the Brazilian negotiators offered the same thing, the Iran then accepted it, but the U.S. then said it's too late. They won't accept it. I think that what U.S. should have done was say this is a good place to begin negotiation and begin to basically try to increase the amount of uranium they would send out for further enrichment. At present, Iran enriches about at a fairly low level that's not military, couldn't be used for the military. And what it needs to is increase more what it claims for medical purposes, but which could also then be used, of course, for military if necessary. But the dangers there are, you know, very long distance. There's no imminent danger. There's plenty of time to negotiate.
Thanks, Saeed, for your call. Mark in Sheboygan, hi.
I just had a quick question. I was wondering if, I don't know that I trust in Western media what's going on in Iran, the size and scope and extent of the opposition. I just don't know. But it makes me wonder if it seems like Iran is clearly a rogue regime, at least in the sense that they're not they haven't bowed down to international pressure, whereas the Saudi regimes, Egypt, all over the Middle East, the West has been really successful in working out Machiavellian types of arrangements with the various royal families and people that have access to the oil revenues. It just makes me wonder if we fail. It seems like this is a situation of a region being very passive aggressive, and you know they've been chained down, these people, throughout the Islamic world by these Western affiliated regimes, and it makes me wonder if we fail with the current attempt of making them into a Hitler-type regime, what that could mean in destabilizing the broader you know, like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, et cetera. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Well, I mean, clearly, I think the American government's problem with Iran isn't its human rights policy. It's really its problem is that Iran doesn't really toe the line on U.S. foreign policy. If the Iran accepted, let's say, its U.S. view on Palestinian-Israeli issue, accepted the U.S. dominance over the Persian Gulf, then, you know, U.S. will be happy with Iran. So it's really a question of, I would say, power struggle between two superpower and a very regional power in the Persian Gulf. Then the human rights issue is then becomes, I think much more of a polemical issue, which the U.S. government occasionally uses to beat on Iran. But that doesn't mean the human rights issue doesn't exist. It does exist. But one shouldn't think it that that's what motivates various administrations. Clearly, in the past, U.S. administrations have not been interested in human rights. And to suddenly think that the new administration is, or should be, or is concerned, it, in a way, taxes one's intelligence.
How many people have left Iran in the last year?
It's not I wouldn't say it's a mass diaspora. There was a big diaspora in 79-80 at the time of the revolution. It's estimated maybe over 1 million people left. And now it's more people who are educated. What has happened after the revolution is a massive expansion of the university education system. And a lot of the graduates have trouble finding jobs in Iran. And especially ones who are intellectually active, want to do social research and so on, find it impossible really within the country. So they are desperate to get out. And you get, it's not a mass immigration, but a substantial immigration of the intelligentsia, mainly actually to Europe. But of course, it's not that easy to get visas, jobs and so on. I mean, if there was, the more people would leave. But basically, you have a big educational system, but lack of the freedom to use that educational system. So people who, once they're educated, get very frustrated on the stifling environment.
And what's the reason for lack of jobs in Iran?
Well, what's happened is the oil money has been used quite effectively in some social programs, such as slum clearance, bringing water to the countryside, drinking water, sanitation, electricity. So the country has been drastically transformed socially since the revolution. But it hasn't been very good at creating, I would say, businesses and type of enterprises that would recruit college graduates. So you get a large pool of people who are all dressed up, ready to work in professions, and those jobs just don't exist because the government hasn't been able to create them. Now, then there are two sort of solutions. One is privatization, sort of the East European model, which some people think it would be the solution, but of course in Eastern Europe it hasn't necessarily worked well. Some people would argue that the state needs to find more resources, which would then be, of course, from abroad with the development of gas and oil, and use those resources to create jobs that would be able to employ the university-educated. So there is a deep-lying of economic problem.
And what about change? Do you anticipate that change is, as some have said, 5 to 10 years down the road, or perhaps just around the corner?
One can't predict. I mean, it's like building up of water up against the dam, and unless the dam sort of releases some of the water, at some point it could really flood over. And it very much depends on what the state decides. In the past, actually, there was hope that the government could open up some valves to bring reform, because the Constitution does have enough flexibility for reform. But what the last election did was it really shut off all that. By rigging the election, it was telling the public that forget about elections. This is an Islamic republic, but it's more Islamic than a republic. The democratic republican side of it is not actually anymore in effect. It's mainly basically a regime that relies on divine rights of the clergy rather than the divine right of the public. Hmm.
Thank you so much, Professor Abrahamian, for being with us.
Thank you.
Our guest this half hour, Professor Ervin Abrahamian, Distinguished Professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern History and Politics at the City University of New York. Thanks also to Jim Sciutto, Senior Foreign Correspondent for ABC News. Rhonda Fanning produced this hour. Thank you, Rhonda. Chrissy Peace, our on-air producer. Thanks to Chrissy, and thank you, everybody, for all of your intelligent calls. News is coming up, and we'll have another hour of conversation this Tuesday here on the Ideas Network.